They stood for a long while in silence. At length the lady spoke again. "Let us return," she said. "In the morning you must depart, for now we have chosen, and the tides of fate are flowing." "I would ask one thing before we go," said Frodo, "a thing which I often meant to ask Gandalf in Rivendell. I'm permitted to wear the one ring. Why cannot I see all the others and know the thoughts of those that wear them?" "You have not tried," she said. "Only thrice have you set the ring upon your finger since you knew what you possessed. Do not try. It would destroy you." "Did not Gandalf tell you that the rings give power according to the measure of each possessor? Before you could use that power, you would need to become far stronger and to train your will to the domination of others. Yet even so, as a ring-bearer, and as one that has borne it on finger and seen that which is hidden, your sight has grown keener. You have perceived my thought more clearly than many that are accounted wise. You saw the eye of him that holds the 7 and the 9, and did you not see and recognize the ring upon my finger?" "Did you see my ring?" she asked, turning again to Sam.
"No, lady," he answered. "To tell you the truth, I wondered what you were talking about. I saw a star through your finger, but if you'll pardon my speaking out, I think my master was right. I wish you'd take his ring. You'd put things to rights. You'd stop them digging up the gaffer and turning him adrift. You'd make some folk pay for their dirty work."
"I would," she said. "That is how it would begin. But it would not stop with that, alas. We will not speak more of it. Let us go." Chapter 8 Farewell to Lorien. That night the company was again summoned to the chamber of Celeborn, and there the lord and lady greeted them with fair words. At length Celeborn spoke of their departure. "Now is the time," he said, "when those who wish to continue the quest must harden their hearts to leave this land. Those who no longer wish to go forward may remain here for a while, but whether they stay or go, none can be sure of peace, for we are come now to the edge of doom. Here those who wish may await the oncoming of the hour till either the ways of the world lie open again, or we summon them to the last need of Lorien. Then they may return to their own lands, or else go to the long home of those that fall in battle." There was silence.
"They all resolved to go forward," said Galadriel, looking in their eyes.
"As for me," said Boromir, "my way home lies onward and not back."
"That is true," said Celeborn. "But is all this company going with you to Minas Tirith?"
"We have not decided our course," said Aragorn. "Beyond Lothlorien, I do not know what Gandalf intended to do. Indeed, I do not think that even he had any clear purpose."
"Maybe not," said Celeborn. "Yet when you leave this land, you can no longer forget the great river. As some of you know well, it cannot be crossed by travellers with baggage between Lorien and Gondor, save by boat. And are not the bridges of Osgiliath broken down, and all the landings held now by the enemy? On which side will you journey? The way to Minas Tirith lies upon this side, upon the west, but the straight road of the quest lies east of the river, upon the darker shore. Which shore will you now take?"
"If my advice is heeded, it will be the western shore and the way to Minas Tirith," answered Boromir.
"But I am not the leader of the company."
The other said nothing, and Aragorn looked doubtful and troubled.
"I see that you do not yet know what to do," said Celeborn. "It is not my part to choose for you, but I will help you as I may. There are some among you who can handle boats. Legolas, whose folk know the swift forest river, and Boromir of Gondor, and Aragorn the traveller."
"And one hobbit," cried Merry. "Not all of us look on boats as wild horses. My people live by the banks of the Brandywine."
"That is well," said Celeborn. "Then I will furnish your company with boats.
They must be small and light, for if you go far by water, there are places where you will be forced to carry them. You will come to the rapids of Sarn Gebir, and maybe at last to the great falls of Rauros, where the river thunders down from Nenhithoil. And there are other perils. Boats may make your journey less toilsome for a while, yet they will not give you counsel. In the end you must leave them in the river and turn west or east.
Aragorn thanked Celeborn many times. The gift of boats comforted him much, not least because there would now be no need to decide his course for some days. The others, too, looked more hopeful. Whatever perils lay ahead, it seemed better to float down the broad tide of Anduin to meet them than to plod forward with bent backs. Only Sam was doubtful. He at any rate still thought boats as bad as wild horses, or worse, and not all the dangers that he had survived made him think better of them.
"All shall be prepared for you and await you at the haven before noon tomorrow," said Celeborn. "I will send my people to you in the morning to help you make ready for the journey. Now we will wish you all a fair night and untroubled sleep."
"Good night, my friends," said Galadriel. "Sleep in peace. Do not trouble your hearts overmuch with thought of the road tonight. Maybe the paths that you each shall tread are already laid before your feet, though you do not see them. Good night."
The company took their leave and returned to their pavilion. Legolas went with them, for this was to be their last night in Lothlorien, and in spite of the words of Galadriel, they wished to take counsel together. For a long time they debated what they should do, and how it would be best to attempt the fulfilling of their purpose with the ring, but they came to no decision. It was plain that most of them desired to go first to Minas Tirith, and to escape, at least for a while, from the terror of the enemy. They would have been willing to follow a leader over the river and into the shadow of Mordor, but Frodo spoke no word, and Aragorn was still divided in his mind. His own plan, while Gandalf remained with them, had been to go with Boromir, and with his sword, help to deliver Gondor. For he believed that the message of the dreams was a summons, and that the hour had come at last when the heir of Elendil should come forth and strive with Sauron for the mastery. But in Moria the burden of Gandalf had been laid on him, and he knew that he could not now forsake the ring if Frodo refused in the end to go with Boromir. And yet what help could he or any of the company give to Frodo, save to walk blindly with him into the darkness? "I shall go to Minas Tirith alone if need be, for it is my duty," said Boromir. And after that he was silent for a while, sitting with his eyes fixed on Frodo, as if he was trying to read the halfling's thoughts. At length he spoke again, softly, as if he was debating with himself.
"If you wish only to destroy the ring," he said, "then there is little use in war and weapons, and the men of Minas Tirith cannot help. But if you wish to destroy the armed might of the Dark Lord, then it is folly to go without force into his domain, and folly to throw away."
He paused suddenly, as if he had become aware that he was speaking his thoughts aloud.
"It would be folly to throw lives away, I mean," he ended. "It's a choice between defending a strong place and walking openly into the arms of death. At least, that is how I see it."
Frodo caught something new and strange in Boromir's glance, and he looked hard at him. Plainly Boromir's thought was different from his final words. It would be folly to throw away what? The Ring of Power? He had said something like this at the council, but then he had accepted the correction of Elrond. Frodo looked at Aragorn, but he seemed deep in his own thought, and made no sign that he had heeded Boromir's words. And so their debate ended. Merry and Pippin were already asleep, and Sam was nodding. The night was growing old. In the morning, as they were beginning to pack their slender goods, elves that could speak their tongue came to them and brought them many gifts of food and clothing for the journey. The food was mostly in the form of very thin cakes, made of a meal that was baked a light brown on the outside, and inside was the color of cream. Gimli took up one of the cakes and looked at it with a doubtful eye.
"Cram," he said under his breath, as he broke off a crisp corner and nibbled at it. His expression quickly changed, and he ate all the rest of the cake with relish.
"No more! No more!" cried the elves, laughing. "You have eaten enough already for a long day's march."
"I thought it was only a kind of cram, such as the Dale men make for journeys in the wild," said the dwarf.
"So it is," they answered. "But we call it lembas, or whey bread, and it is more strengthening than any food made by men, and it is more pleasant than cram, by all accounts."
"Indeed it is," said Gimli. "Why, it's better than the honey cakes of the Beornings, and that is great praise, for the Beornings are the best bakers that I know of. But they are none too willing to deal out their cakes to travellers in these days. You are kindly hosts."
"All the same, we bid you spare the food," they said. "Eat little at a time, and only at need, for these things are given to serve you when all else fails. The cakes will keep sweet for many, many days, if they are unbroken and left in their leaf wrappings, as we have brought them. One will keep a traveller on his feet for a day of long labour, even if he be one of the tall men of Minas Tirith." The elves next unwrapped and gave to each of the company the clothes they had brought. For each they had provided a hood and a cloak, made according to his size, of the light but warm silken stuff that the Galathrim wove. It was hard to say of what colour they were. Grey with a hue of twilight under the trees they seemed to be. And yet if they were moved, or set in another light, they were green as shadowed leaves, or brown as fallow fields by night, dusk silver as water under the stars. Each cloak was fastened about the neck with a brooch like a green leaf veined with silver.
"Are these magic cloaks?" asked Pippin, looking at them with wonder.
"I do not know what you mean by that," answered the leader of the elves. "They are fair garments, and the web is good, for it was made in this land. They are elvish robes, certainly, if that is what you mean. Leaf and branch, water and stone, they have the hue and beauty of all these things under the twilight of Lorien that we love, for we put the thought of all that we love into all that we make. Yet they are garments, not armour, and they will not turn shaft or blade. But they should serve you well. They are light to wear, and warm enough or cool enough at need, and you will find them a great aid in keeping out of the sight of unfriendly eyes, whether you walk among the stones or the trees. You are indeed high in the favour of the lady. For she herself and her maidens wove this stuff, and never before have we clad strangers in the garb of our own people." After their morning meal, the company said farewell to the lawn by the fountain. Their hearts were heavy, for it was a fair place, and it had become like home to them, though they could not count the days and nights that they had passed there. As they stood for a moment looking at the white water in the sunlight, Haldir came walking towards them over the green grass of the glade. Frodo greeted him with delight.
"I have returned from the northern fences," said the elf, "and I am sent now to be your guide again. The Dimrill Dale is full of vapour and clouds of smoke, and the mountains are troubled. There are noises in the deeps of the earth. If any of you had thought of returning northwards to your homes, you would not have been able to pass that way. But come, your path now goes south." As they walked through Carras Galathon, the green ways were empty, but in the trees above them many voices were murmuring and singing. They themselves went silently. At last, Haldir led them down the southward slopes of the hills,
and they came again to the great gate hung with lamps, and to the white bridge. And so they passed out and left the city of the elves. Then they turned away from the paved road and took a path that went off into a deep thicket of mallorn trees and passed on, winding through rolling woodlands of silver shadow, leading them ever down, southwards and eastwards, towards the shores of the river. They had gone some 10 miles, and noon was at hand, when they came on a high green wall. Passing through an opening, they came suddenly out of the trees. Before them lay a long lawn of shining grass, studded with golden Eleanor that glinted in the sun. The lawn ran out into a narrow tongue between bright margins. On the right and west, the silver load flowed glittering. On the left and east, the great river rolled its broad waters, deep and dark. On the further shores, the woodlands still marched on southwards as far as the eye could see. But all the banks were bleak and bare. No mallorn lifted its gold-hung boughs beyond the land of Lorien. On the bank of the silver load, at some distance up from the meeting of the streams, there was a hythe of white stones and white wood. By it were moored many boats and barges. Some were brightly painted, and shone with silver and gold and green, but most were either white or grey. 3 small grey boats had been made ready for the travellers, and in these the elves stowed their goods. And they added also coils of rope, 3 to each boat. Slender they looked, but strong, silken to the touch, grey of hue like the elven cloaks. "What are these?" asked Sam, handling one that lay upon the greensward. "Ropes, indeed," answered an elf from the boats. "Never travel far without a rope, and one that is long and strong and light. Such are these. They may be a help in many needs." "You don't need to tell me that," said Sam. "I came without any, and I've been worried ever since. But I was wondering what these were made of, knowing a bit about rope-making. It's in the family, as you might say." "They are made of hithline," said the elf. "But there is no time now to instruct you in the art of their making. Had we known that this craft delighted you, we could have taught you much. But now, alas, unless you should at some time hither return, you must be content with our gift. May it serve you well." "Come," said Haldir. "All is now ready for you. Enter the boats, but take care at first." "Heed the words," said the other elves. "These boats are light-built, and they are crafty, and unlike the boats of other folk, they will not sink. Lade them as you will, but they are wayward if mishandled. It would be wise if you accustom yourselves to stepping in and out. Here, where there is a landing-place, before you set off downstream." The company was arranged in this way. Aragorn, Frodo, and Sam were in one boat, Boromir, Merry, and Pippin in another, and in the third were Legolas and Gimli, who had now become fast friends. In this last boat most of the goods and packs were stowed. The boats were moved and steered with short-handled paddles that had broad leaf-shaped blades. When all was ready, Aragorn led them on a trial up the silver load. The current was swift, and they went forward slowly. Sam sat in the bows, clutching the sides, and looking back wistfully to the shore. The sunlight glittering on the water dazzled his eyes. As they passed beyond the green field of the tongue, the trees drew down to the river's bank. Here and there golden leaves tossed and floated on the rippling stream. The air was very bright and still, and there was a silence, except for the high, distant song of larks. They turned a sharp bend in the river, and there, sailing proudly down the stream toward them, they saw a swan of great size. The water rippled on either side of the white breast beneath its curving neck. Its beak shone like burnished gold, and its eyes glinted like jet set in yellow stones.
Its huge white wings were half lifted. A music came down the river as it drew nearer, and suddenly they perceived that it was a ship, wrought and carved with elven skill in the likeness of a bird. Two elves clad in white steered it with black paddles. In the midst of the vessel sat Celeborn, and behind him stood Galadriel, tall and white. A circlet of golden flowers was in her hair, and in her hand she held a harp, and she sang. Sad and sweet was the sound of her voice in the cool, clear air.
I sang of leaves of gold, and leaves of gold there grew. Of wind I sang, a wind there came, and in the branches blew. Beyond the sun, beyond the moon, the foam was on the sea, and by the strand of Ilmarin there grew a golden tree.